Hello, this is the podcast for our class on September 13, and it was class number 5, and it's our final class talking about the element of breach, that is, breaching your duty of reasonable care. And all along we've been talking about how to define the duty of reasonable care, how you can instruct the jury, help the jury with reasonable care examples, statute violation, custom. Now we're talking about what happens when you have no evidence, when you just have no direct evidence, and of course we need evidence to get to the jury, we need some facts to get to the jury. Have you lost your case? No, because tort law recognizes, evidentiary law recognizes that tort facts and evidence, it's fleeting, and we've talked about that plenty, why, you know, things, witnesses fade. You don't have things written on paper. You don't have documents like you do in contracts. It's the tort happens, the accident happens, it gets cleaned up. Very frequently, there's no evidence whatsoever. So, instead of sending our plaintiffs away, torts has developed rules of evidence that allow you to get to the jury when your facts, when your direct evidence is not available. And we compared the two cases of Negri v. Stop and Shop with the case of Gordon v. Museum of Natural History. And those cases both dealt with the type of evidence that is called constructive evidence. That means it's basically not real. And deals with the situations of reasonable care. Of course, we're always looking at reasonable care. We expect people to, landowners, property owners, operators, to avoid unreasonable risks and clean up, make safe their property for dangerous situations of which they have notice. We don't say you're always going to be liable if anybody's injured on your property or on your business. That would be strict liability. We say you have reasonable care requires that you make safe or behave reasonably under the circumstances. And the circumstances have to be that you know that there's a dangerous condition. Could you all know? Yeah, but you should know there's a dangerous condition, and you should make that safe. And the court, the law of evidence allows us, instead of actual notice, allows us to substitute constructive notice. All constructive notice is that you should have known this. And here we see, in these two cases, the question is, was the dangerous condition around long enough so that we say that the owner had constructive notice of it? In Negri, the whole question was, how long had the dangerous condition existed? Well, we don't know exactly, you know, but we know that nobody had heard glass breaking, and it was brought about by a broken bottle of jar of baby food. The baby food itself was all smeary. We know it hadn't been, nobody had been clean for a certain length of time. So putting those facts together, the court could determine that there were enough facts to go to jury so the jury could infer constructive notice. All we need to do is, all the plaintiff wants to do is get to the jury. The defendant's trying to stop it. Contrasted with Gordon, that didn't have any facts, sufficient facts in dispute to get to the jury. The paper, they slipped on a paper, came from a vendor nearby. The museum was responsible for the condition of their steps, but there's nothing in evidence, no facts available, there were no facts available to allow a jury to infer no constructive notice. So that's all we were talking about there is, we had, are there sufficient facts so that a reasonable jury could find for the plaintiff? And the theory of constructive notice is just a matter of rule of circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence, that's all it is we don't have real evidence, so you can infer from the circumstances presented. Suppose there's no evidence, and then we did the little hypotheticals, and make sure you understand why we're doing those things. It wasn't just to be silly, it was to really focus in on the use of facts to allow you to get to the jury. None of the things we talked about was direct evidence of the tripping or the slipping or anything that we're talking about. Nobody saw anything except some roundabout evidence, circumstantial evidence. But that's sufficient to get you to the jury so that a jury can make an inference of breach. And remember, we have a very low burden of proof here. So it's not, circumstantial evidence can certainly meet that burden of proof in torts, where it may not in criminal law. Then we looked at situations where there's no evidence available whatsoever. And the court, instead of, again, sending you home, the court has developed another rule of circumstantial evidence called res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. What is the thing? The thing is the accident. Under certain circumstances, there are certain accidents that would not happen but for negligence. And because of that, the court will allow you to get to the jury. It's not constructive notice. It's not anything along that way. It's the fact of the accident. Just because this accident happened, the court will allow you to get a jury. So res ipsa is hugely powerful too. You can see a jury then, based on knowing that this accident happened, can infer negligence. Res ipsa has the four requirements, three plus another one. And I always say four. It's the type of accident that doesn't ordinarily happen without negligence. The plaintiff had nothing to do with it. The defendant was in exclusive control of the instrumentality, and that's a big one. And the defendant is the one most likely to have the evidence at hand. So we talked about Byrne v. Bodle. That's our classic res ipsa case. Somebody gets hit by a barrel. A plaintiff gets knocked out. They have no way of knowing anything. The barrel was in the exclusive control of the defendant. The plaintiff was certainly blameless. And if anybody knows anything, it's the defendant. Res ipsa gets you to the jury. Doesn't, without any evidence on the part of the plaintiff, res ipsa will get you there. We talked about, and this is powerful, you can see. Then the following case, we have a big missing piece of critical evidence, gone missing, a dog ate it. This probably isn't a great res ipsa case, probably, maybe tires fall off, we don't know. But without this critical evidence, our plaintiff has no way of showing this. So res ipsa moves it forward to the jury without, because of missing evidence, basically. And kind of forces the defendant to fess up. The defendant was the one in control of this tire. And there's a chain missing. Defendant had altered this tire clamp. And this chain that was involved in that suddenly goes missing. Critical piece of evidence. SIPSA was permitted here, although it's really not a wonderful case for res ipsa, permitted here because the defendant You know, once you get to the jury, defendant's got to start talking up. Once you get to the jury, the defendant's going to start talking. And then Ibarra v. Spangard, very famous case, very controversial, terrible case for res ipsa. Why was it granted here? Well, because we had six doctors who all dummied up, who none of them was going to say they knew what went on in the operating room. Very common scenario of a lot of doctors in an operating room, an unconscious plaintiff. Plaintiff wakes up, something happened during the operation. Plaintiff is the last person to be able to know what happened. The doctors all, you know, nobody saw anything. Res ipsa is allowed in these cases, even though they're not so wonderful. Why exclusive control of the instrumentality? We don't even know what the instrumentality was, the damage, and too many defendants, really. But res ipsa is not allowed in these cases. No plaintiff would ever win. We would have no plaintiff ever getting to a jury. So res ipsa here was granted, and it was very controversial. Res ipsa was granted because otherwise there would be no case whatsoever. Presumably, the plaintiff then gets to the jury, and the defendant has to start talking. And one of those six defendants is going to start talking about that. So res ipsa, very controversial. It was used as a club, it was just used as a way to threaten it mainly. So there's a lot of controversy over this case. So you see that res ipsa is so powerful that it's a big tool in the plaintiff's arsenal. Okay, so next class, we're going to have our quiz. We're going to start on a whole new section, leaving behind breach and starting on the section called duty. So next class, quiz for the first 10 minutes, and then we'll go into talking about the duty requirement.